get themselves into better living conditions.
It's the Legally Moral edition of Radio Free Thinker. This week, universities and alt-med, taxing the Vatican, and legislating morality. Let's begin episode 154.
It's time for Radio Free Thinker, the show that applies skepticism and critical thinking to everyday issues. The place where reason and reality cross swords for politics, religion, economics, and of course, science. Now let's get ready to be skeptical.
The cosmos is also within us. We're made of sparks. We are away from the cosmos and know itself.
Across the sea of space, the stars are others, and we've traveled this way before, and there is much to be learned.
Hello, and welcome to Radio Free Thinker, the radio show podcast that promotes skepticism and critical thinking, right here on CITR 101.9 FM in Vancouver. This is Ethan, your free-thinking historian.
And this is Don, your skeptical philosopher and political scientist.
Well, Don, Radio Free Thinker was on break last week.
We were.
We aired one of our best of episodes. Hopefully our listeners enjoyed it.
Yes, yes. Hopefully it was excellent, because obviously you can never get enough of us, and having us a second time around has got to be better. It's like, you know, leftovers in the fridge. They just get more mellow with age.
Absolutely. Now, Don, I know that you're a big advocate of privacy. You don't like your personal life, the details revealed.
How'd you know that? Who told you that? That's supposed to be a secret.
Yes, well, I found out that there's only really two sides of this question. You're either on the side of law and order, or you're on the side of child pornographers.
No comment.
Yeah. So I'm flippantly referring to a controversial new bill being pushed through by the Canadian government known as C-30, which allows law enforcement unprecedented access to your online history, allowing your ISP information to be used without a warrant. The so-called lawful access bill, which would increase the amount of information about customers that telecommunication companies are forced to keep, and ease the restrictions against them being made public to law enforcement.
Ethan, I have to correct you. It's no longer called the lawful access bill. It's actually changed its name to the, I'm sure, the more appropriate Protecting Children from Internet Predators Act.
Well, that might be apt, because Vic Taze, the Federal Minister of Public Safety, the man behind this bill, has recently declared that critics can either stand with us or with the child pornographers. Well, it turns out that Taze has chosen to stand with the pornographers. He got a taste of what his bill would be like when an anonymous Twitter user started tweeting personal information about him. The tweets, which apparently originated from a House of Commons IP address, that's interesting, revealed personal information about Taze, including his divorce information. Later, he abruptly changed his tone when he revealed to the CBC that he was unaware of any portion of his new bill that would allow police to access private information without a warrant. When he was shown direct quotes from his bill that did indeed indicate that police could access private information without a warrant, he was taken aback by this and said, "This is the first time I'm hearing this somehow extends ordinary police emergency powers. In my opinion, it doesn't, and it shouldn't." This change of attitude has also coincided with outrage across the country from privacy advocates, many of whom have taken to online protests, like using a Twitter hashtag, #TellVicEverything, as well as emailing Taves with mundane information like, "Taking out the trash now," or "Just made a sandwich, use peanut butter." Others are suggesting that Taze should have closed-circuit surveillance cameras installed in his house to monitor for child porn.
Yeah. This bill in so many ways has shown the worst side of Canadian politics. First, I am sure most of you know that the bill was formally called, as we just mentioned, Lawful Access Bill, and is now the Protecting Children from Internet Predators Act, although it makes no reference to children or pedophilia in the act itself. The name change happened pretty quickly and seems to have been completely propagandistic in its reasoning. Actually, it was so quickly done, that you can actually check out that the original filing that Vic did at 10 a.m. actually had the short title of Lawful Access. However, it was quickly reprinted in the exact same bill, with the exception of a new short title, Protecting Children from Internet Predators, was substituted. In fact, the government may be open to a copyright infringement claim because in 1997, a U.S. congressman presented a bill to the U.S. with the exact same name. Of course, his bill actually had something to do with stopping child predators on the Internet. Another way it exemplifies the poor state of politics is the point that you made about Vic being surprised to learn what was actually in the bill that he was presenting to Parliament. And it wasn't like some minor little bit. It was actually a huge thing that he had sort of just completely overlooked. I mean, how is he... the bill gave security agencies access to private personal information without any legal oversight, i.e. judicial consent. Now, it's fair that these powers were meant to be used only under exceptional circumstances, the sort of 24 rule, I guess, would be. Mm-hmm. But the terms that they use are so loosely defined. Lastly, he made a point about, you commented mostly about standing with the pedophiles, that when he made that statement, he said that it wasn't meant to say that people were supporting pedophilia. So does this mean that if you stand by Vic, that you're not actually supporting the bill? I mean, how else are you supposed to take the term standing with pedophiles? It's a disingenuous comment, and one that I'm sure was not a slip of the tongue. Often the Harper government has been accused the opposition of outrageous rhetoric, but here we have a prime example of committing a near Godwin right out of the block. For those of you not acquainted with the Godwin law, that is, any argument that the first side makes a reference to the Nazis, that side loses debate. So if it's a law, does the act get passed, automatically not passed because they've broken the law and trying to... Yeah, okay, sorry. I'm going down logical and literary things. But the last point I guess I'm going to make is just this morning I was listening to CBC, and Vic Taves went on the air and he said, listen, I'm sorry that other people have misunderstood what I said, and I apologize if they didn't know what I meant when I said standing with pedophiles, which is your classic non-apology apology.
Yeah. Well, I mean, it's a common thing, though, to... I mean, we're familiar with this in skepticism. When we're having a debate with somebody, they'll use really emotionally charged language, not so much to convince us through their argument and their evidence, but to use this really extreme example that makes us go, well, I don't want to be with the child pornographers. That has no bearing on whether or not this bill actually helps protect children at all. It's just he's using this emotionally charged language to say, you know, well, you, never mind the evidence, never mind, you know, due process. It's scariness and child pornography and think of the children.
You know, and it leads to another thing that a lot of people say, well, you know, sometimes we'll make examples about bad politics with the American context. And we say, well, you know, that doesn't happen here in Canada. Whereas if you ever take a look at, like I say, American laws, quite often they say a law about... roads is the, this will prevent children from being killed, and if you don't like this bill, you're a horrible person, as the name of the bill. I mean, they have the really weird names for some bills. But this shows that that sort of American rhetoric is moving here to Canada.
Well, the extreme language use in what should be, you know, evidence-based critical thinking is a disturbing trend, obviously.
It is, and it's one that seems to be growing in our society. I mean, to be fair, and I don't think the people who are against this bill are doing it to the same extreme, but they have been. I mean, there's been some fake commercials I've seen by a group called openmedia.ca where they have equated that this law is equivalent to having the RCMP rummage through your fridge when you're not home, or to literally eavesdrop on your communications when you're not there. And although, again, with a proper search warrant, they can do that, this law hasn't quite gone that far yet, although it's definitely on the road to that.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, we do have a fantastic show today. Don, why don't you get us started with some interesting news out of Australia?
Yes, well, apparently there's this group called the Friends of Science and Medicine, a recently formed group that includes more than 400 prominent scientists, doctors, academic, and consumer advocates from Australia and overseas, who wrote to the vice chancellors of Australian universities last month. They outlined their concerns about what they called the diminishing of standards applied to teaching of science in our universities and the increased teaching of pseudoscience. The letter went on to say, such courses involved so-called complementary or alternative medicine masquerading as and sitting side by side with evidence-based health-related science courses. So essentially, they were sort of calling out the universities that have, you know, chiropractic courses, homeopathic courses, naturopath, herbalism, and saying that in doing this, you are diminishing the stature of real science of the university itself as an educational institution. In response to this, the universities have pushed back. Nick Klomp, Dean of Science Faculty at Charles Stewart University, agreed with some of the points of the letter, but continued to state that the degree offered at his university, a Bachelor of Science bracket complementary medicine, for example, was based on science. He said the degree was designed to impart evidence-based science to people who already had a qualification, like a diploma in alternative healthcare. The degree included courses in subjects like biology and physiology. Those behind the letter said, for many of us, we've been concerned for a long time that this is the most scientific of all ages and pseudoscience seems to be flourishing. Dave Colquhoun, a professor of pharmacology at the University College of London, who has called for an ending of alternative medicine programs in London, a member of the Australian group, had some of the harshest words to say in the article, which was, courses in alternative medicine are dishonest. They teach things that aren't true and the things that are and things that are dangerous to patients in some cases. Now, I don't think I have to take a survey of our studio here to know that we probably support the Friends of Science and would be glad to see all CAM programs ended in higher institutions, with the caveat made that made by the Friends group as well, that research into some CAM is appropriate as long as it's warranted. That said, one thing that Klomp had said made me pause. He said, I could ignore them or I could train them better. He added that a majority of these university students were already practicing and said, we actually create graduates who are much better at healthcare providers. It's all about evidence-based and science-based. So the argument, I think, is even if you think CAM is a fake, there is some aspect to harm reduction that they're promoting here. That these people would be practicing their pseudoscience regardless. That this way, at least, they have an understanding of what real medicine is and the ethics attached to it. Our show has endorsed the principle of harm reduction with regards to illegal drugs. We often talk that many CAM practitioners are not necessarily frauds, but just misinformed. This seems to be one way, at least, that you could reduce the potential harm that could be done to their patients, at least via ignorance. But that's debatable.
So the idea here being is it's almost like covert skepticism. They're coming in to learn about alternative medicine, but they get instead science-based medicine.
I think and these are people, again, because I think genuine frauds aren't going to benefit from this. But yeah. I think what they're sort of saying is that you have people out there who are doing this anyhow. They're doing chiropractic, for example, which I think is probably the most dangerous one you can be doing. And they're certified from their official unit, but they want to know more about medicine because they really have this urge to help their patients, and they think that the pseudoscience is helping their patients. So they go in there, and they learn about what real medicine is all about. And they know that, well, you know, I thought that this was possible, but I've learned some critical thinking skills and some real medicine, and that really, it's dubious for me to make that claim. And even if I'm going to still make the claim, I may not actually do things that I know will potentially hurt my patients.
Well, that's, I think, a good idea in some cases. I mean, you don't really want to turn people away from science when they're trying to learn something. And especially if they are, you know, already sort of knee-deep inside the alternative medicine community, education in science might be what they need to sort of steer them towards more evidence-based lines of thinking. Of course, that all depends on how that course is being marketed as well. I could certainly see the friends of science here having an issue with a university sort of rubber stamping chiropractic or homeopathy or something like that. So I think that they have to be very clear exactly what it is they're sort of teaching and what their goals are, so to speak, with this sort of course. Because again, but I think both sides here have a reasonable point. You don't want the universities to be endorsing this kind of chiropractic alternative medicine stuff, and at the same time, you don't want to turn away potentially curious, science enthusiast people who may not have had the same background as some of these other, scientists.
I think you hit up on one thing that's quite critical in this discussion, is the idea of marketing. On the one hand, if they are marketing, if they're using the terminology of CAM, of alternative medicine and that, in order to bring in these people who would normally ignore the established medical establishment, in quotes, then I guess that has some validity. But, of course, you do point out the counter-argument is the fact that this does actually provide a certain amount of respectability and gravitas to these things. I mean, if I know I can get a degree in homeopathy, then somehow doesn't that make when we sit there and say homeopathy is a bunch of crap, you go, well, why do they teach a university course in it?
Yeah, exactly right. Definitely, there is a fine line to this, I suppose. But an interesting development. I mean, hopefully the friends of science here, in this case, will be able to detect when more good is being done than harm.
Well, let's hope they use evidence-based.
Yeah.
And they keep track of graduates to see, is there this? I'd actually be really curious to know what our listeners think about this. Because, again, this whole spin about harm reduction is one I hadn't really thought about before. And so I'd be curious to know what our listeners think. Please give us your opinions and your comments at info@radiofreethinker.com. We'd eagerly like to hear what you have to say, and maybe we can add on to this topic at a later date.
Well, why don't we take a commercial break here on Radio Free Thinker, and we'll be back with more after this.
Standing on a planet, really I'm just a speck, compared with a star.
Radio Free Thinker is broadcast Tuesdays at 3:30 p.m. on CITR 101.9 FM in Vancouver. You can also hear us Mondays at 8 a.m. on UMFM 101.5 FM in Winnipeg, Fridays at 3 p.m. on CFBX 92.5 FM in Kamloops, and Saturdays at 9 a.m. on CKXU 88.3 FM in Lethbridge. Our thanks to all the stations that broadcast Radio Free Thinker and help promote skepticism and critical thinking. If you would like to have Radio Free Thinker syndicated on your local station, please email us at info@radiofreethinker.com.
We have traveled this way before, and there is much to be learned.
Black History Month is the brainchild of the great African-American historian and activist Carter G. Woodson. Born in 1975, Woodson grew up recognizing that the history of African-Americans, along with other cultures, were being ignored or misrepresented. Originating in Chicago as Negro History Week in 1926, Black History Month reached official status in Canada by 1995. This was mainly through the efforts of two women, the first Black Canadian woman elected to Parliament, the Honorable Jean Augustine, and Rosemary Sadlier, president of the Ontario Black History Society. Get out and really hustle. This PSA was brought to you in support of Black History Month on CITR 101.9 FM.
Eventually I'll be left behind. If I don't get a move on, gotta put my shoes on.
Become a friend of CITR and get great discounts in the Main Street area at
Antisocial Skateboard Shop, Devil May Wear, Flaming Angels Boutique, Lucky's Comics, Neptune Records, Red Cat Records, the Regional Assembly of Text, RX Comics, Temple of the Modern Girl, and the Wallflower Modern Diner.
It pays to be a friend of CITR. To learn more, come visit us in room 233 of the sub on UBC campus or check us out online at citr.ca.
And we're back on Radio Free Thinker here on CITR. So, as listeners are probably aware, there has been much changing in Italy at the moment.
Well, they're going bankrupt, are they not?
Among other things, yes.
Yeah, Greece has, Spain has. It's just economic hell in a handbasket, from what I understand.
Well, at the moment, Italy is going to throw one more bit of tradition on its head. We have news that the new prime minister is revoking the Vatican's tax exemption on the church's commercial property.
What?
That's right, Don. The annual cost could be up to 720 million euros, a fair chunk of change. Now, Italy's Catholic Church has over 110,000 properties. By some estimations, 20% of Italy's real estate. And the total value of this real estate is around 9 billion euros.
Wow.
These properties include shopping centers and a wide range of residential property. They're not just, you know, churches. They're actually non-religious buildings in nature. Perhaps a chapel that has a hostel in it, or perhaps a mission that has a grocery store or apartments, that kind of thing.
Retirement homes, I imagine, would be in
yeah,
there.
Yeah, probably as well. Now, previously, they had been tax-exempt on everything. Now, since the economic downturn, Italy passed a number of acts to increase tax income, including property taxes. However, the average person was sort of wondering, well, why is the church being exempt from this? There was actually an online petition that more than 130,000 people signed, asking for the church to lose its exempt status. Now, since 2005, church-run groups and organizations have not been official commercial bodies, and therefore have been exempt from paying the property taxes on these real estates that they own. Now, according to the Corriere della Sera newspaper, tax authorities will calculate how much of a property is used purely for religious purposes and tax it proportionally. So this means that a church will remain exempt, but a chapel which operates the hostel would pay tax accordingly. So this is a big step, not just for economic concerns in Italy, but also for secularism as well in Italy. For a country that has had a very close alliance with the Catholic Church, going all the way back to when Mussolini first forged this alliance, the Catholic Church has been given a lot of extraordinary powers in Italy, a lot of exemptions to laws that would normally operate on people from everything from taxation to, you know, literally breaking the law and doing bad things.
Well, you may not know this, Ethan, but at one point, the Papal States controlled a significant amount of Italy.
I heard of this, yes.
Yeah.
So, I mean, chipping away at the Catholic Church privilege in Italy is, I mean, a major step for secularists everywhere. I mean, we've been talking about, you know, secularism in Europe for a long time, whether that's in France or, you know, the Low Countries or Spain or wherever. Traditionally, many of these countries are naturally not that religious. But Italy is the crown jewel of the Vatican's empire. For them to revoke tax-exempt status from these religious institutions is a serious blow to the church's power.
Well, I think it also points to another thing, which, again, religion in Europe is frankly weird from our standards, although I think we're the weird ones and they're not. So much of it is wrapped up in the idea of culture and tradition. And that being said, I think a lot of the tax-exempt status, the privilege that the Vatican has been a lot traditional, as you mentioned. You know, there's a lot of strong historical ties. And granted, unlike places like Sweden, a significant majority of people in Italy claim to be Catholic. But you got the same thing that happened in Ireland with divorce. I think they've only got divorced. I don't think they've gone to abortion yet, but they're working there. Where, when it comes to sort of the needs of the society, tradition can be broken. And I think this is what you're seeing here in Italy, is that, you know, when religion no longer has any benefit and has actually become a major drag on the society, even the most religious of people will sit there and say, well, okay, you know, reality does trump theology, even at the hardest, the most basic sense.
Right. And I mean, also the fact that people in Italy who, you know, are suffering because of the economic downturn, they're starting to catch on to this whole sort of, you know, idea of a church built around the teachings of a, you know, homeless man whose current vicar lives in a palace. There's some sort of cognitive dissonance going on there, I think, and they're sort of, wait a second, something's not right here.
Yeah, no, there's actually a hilarious thing I heard about on one of my decadent left-wing shows about if Jesus was trying to run for the Republican Party right now, he'd just be laughed off right off the stage because,
yeah.
You know. But this does lead into something more poignant, I think, for us here in Canada. Because, I mean, they make the exception still for churches in Italy, but we still have tax exempt statuses for churches here. And some people have complained that actually that what qualifies as church property, because, I mean, it's supposed to be something that is supposed to be public. It's supposed to be serving either an educational or social, which includes religious purpose. But the people who enforce this law is, again, government officials, and although I love regulation, often is underserved. So I wonder how many church properties here in Canada sort of are technically church-related but aren't. Again, like I'm thinking things like old folks' homes or something like that.
Well, even there are plenty of religious groups in Canada that have a lot of restrictions on who can enter and, you know, use their facilities, which sort of defeats the whole purpose of having this kind of like public space for whether it's worship or whether it's education or whether it's sanctuary, when only a certain group of people are allowed to use that service.
Right. And the whole point of giving tax-exempt service is the churches are, in theory, providing a public service to the people.
Exactly. Well, let's take another commercial break here on Radio Free Thinker, and we'll be back after this. To subscribe to the Radio Free Thinker podcast and take it on the go and download previous episodes, subscribe via iTunes or at radiofreethinker.com. Remember to like us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter at CITRRFT. If you have any questions, comments, or thoughts to share with us, email at info@radiofreethinker.com. Understanding empowers you.
Well, how best to explain it? You've seen me in X-Men.
Yeah.
The character I am, Professor Charles Xavier. Mm. If you remember, he can control things with the power of his mind.
Yeah.
Make people do things and see things. So I thought, what if you can do that for real? I mean, not in a comic book world, but in the real world.
All right.
So in my film, I play a man who controls the world with his mind.
Right. That's interesting.
Yeah, for instance, I'm walking along. And I see this beautiful girl, and I think I'd like to see her naked, and so all her clothes fall off.
All her clothes fall off?
Yes. And she's scrabbling around to get them back on again, but even before she can get her knickers on, I've seen everything. You know, I've seen it all.
You're listening to CITR 101.9 FM Vancouver. We've already seen everything.
Okay. It's a comedy, is it?
No.
The East Vancouver Helpline is here to help. Open from 9 to 4, Monday to Friday, the Helpline answers questions about HIV and safer sex. Call to find medical support in your area without giving your name. Run by volunteers, the Helpline is one of many programs from AIDS Vancouver combating the HIV epidemic in the Lower Mainland. While not medical professionals, our volunteers answer your questions confidentially and anonymously. The Helpline number is 604-696-4666 or contact us online at www.aidsvancouver.org.
And we're back. I've gotten a lot of feedback from my blog post and our segment about gender selection, and more to the point, whether we should legislate morality. For those of you who didn't listen to that particular segment, shame on you, but we talked about whether a law should be passed to prevent a woman from knowing the sex of her child because she may take that information and have a abortion based on that gender, and that we as a society think that sexism and sexism is wrong. So essentially the idea is that this law would be legislating morality. Some people have expressed the view that we actually should legislate morality because the laws that skeptics would enact would help make the world a better place as opposed to those that we think religious people would make a worse place, maybe. My response to this is to reiterate my opinion last week that I think it's bad to legislate morality. First, there is the reverse implication. If we create moral laws, that implies all laws are somehow moral, something history has shown time and again not to be true. That said, I don't know if we're talking about the same thing, and that is often the problem with philosophy. When the religious, conservative, or traditional uses the word morality, they mean metaphysically right, the ought versus the is, What is moral is always moral. It transcends time and space. Moral is the word of God and is immutable. Often, in the skeptic community, we hear this with regards to libertarian or, dare I say, some socialist thinking. We hold to some precept or foundational aspect a priori. Regardless of where it's coming from, it is seen as moral, irrespective of what the reality might be. Although the original meaning of morality comes from the Latin moralis, simply meaning proper custom, centuries of Christian influence and indoctrination has, in my opinion, irrevocably altered it to right, good, and virtuous. In the skeptic article that was pointed out by one of our loyal listeners, thanks Ian for your input, the article argues that not only can we legislate morality, but that we must do so. Although he makes some token appeal to empirical evidence, one of his main premises, and this is where I have an issue, is where he states, if our consciousness tells us that some action may cause great harm to society, you have both the right and, I believe, the duty to try and help or correct that situation through both social and political means. It appears it is the appeal to conscience that I find problematic. It lays moral law on the foundation of belief and opinion and not fact or reason. In the article, written by what I would guess is a libertarian, it shows why we should not think in terms of morality because we are too culturally indoctrinated to think of this dogmatically. The article later states, we don't limit or take away the right to free speech just because a person exercises that right leads to death. The author praises Obama's book, The Audacity of Hope, where it states, I propose that most law, either in spirit or letter, is nothing but encoded morality. One must ask, whose morality? That is the heart of my criticism. Morality is, at least in our modern context, dogmatic. Dogmatism, be it theocratic, political, or skeptical, is innately wrong, regardless of the good it may incidentally do. Using the term morality, this necessarily must appeal to belief and the metaphysical, creating a field of competing equals. The Christian belief is right or wrong based on the Bible is no less sound than one's belief on the philosophy of inalienable rights. Yet both may be invalid because they are asserted as beliefs and not discovered knowledge. This is why I don't think we should legislate morality. So do I think that laws can make society better? Yes. Do I think we should use law to modify people's behavior in order to make that society better? Yes, but cautiously. Do I think I should impose my moral beliefs on others through law? No. No matter how right I might think they are or how much incidental good they may do. What I would do is approach law like I do everything else. I use the tools of skepticism, evidence, logic, reason, and the scientific method to create laws ethically. Okay, what do I mean by ethically? Is this just some different way of saying morality? Yes and no. There is a conflation between ethics and morality. However, they are not really the same. Morality is a judgment on something. Ethics is more of a process, a way of doing things. I believe we should make law that is consistent with empirical evidence, rational thinking, what I could call ethical thinking. I think ethical thinking is a method like the scientific method. It is not an answer, but a method to derive answers. Ethical thinking is, at least as a good skeptic would apply it, should not be dogmatic, can evolve over time, can point to truth, but can never claim to actually be it. So laws created with ethical thinking are not moral or immoral. They are the best attempt to make society better. We can say laws are ethical or unethical. For example, the article said free speech should be maintained even if it resulted in death. To be fair, he did make an exception for yelling fire in a crowded theater as unethical because it ignores in a crowded theater, but this is still unethical because it ignores some things like hate speech. I can say unethical because he is dogmatic in his view of rights, thus not willing to change it based on evidence. It's doubly dogmatic because he makes an exception for one harm, but yet not for another. For example, genocide, which somehow seems to me a greater harm than yelling in a theater would be. His exclusion is arbitrary because it's based on his beliefs. This view of rights are asserted to be true, and as in the U.S. Declaration of Independence, a notable document, but one that asserts we hold these truths to be self-evident and all men are created equal. Although I may be sympathetic to these words, anything asserted is dogmatic and innately unethical, because the king could equally assert all men are subject to the king. Here's an example. When a law is based in morality, we are stuck saying pot smoking is immoral forever because something is either moral or immoral. There is not a kind of moral. By using the M word, you create dogmatic law. Ethical thinking gets around this dilemma because its outcomes are not moral, but the best answers so far, like science. So we can say in 1980, pot smoking causes major harm to individuals in society. And yet, as more research provides evidence that it may be not as harmful, we can alter our law statement by saying pot smoking causes little harm to self or the state without being inconsistent, because both laws were created ethically, but the law itself isn't moral or immoral. So now we return to our original question. Should we legislate morality? No. I think doing so lowers ourselves to the same level as the theocrats we often decry. I do, however, think we can use law to make society better and its citizens better through laws that are created ethically. For example, income redistribution, again, socialist, sorry. I think, again, ethically created laws can make for a better world, provided it uses the same skeptical skills that we've used in everything else. Empirical evidence, rationality, the scientific method. Thoughts?
Well, I mean, I think I would agree to a large portion that, you know, we shouldn't allow whatever laws that we make to be founded on sort of an immovable doctrine. I think that's a recipe for disaster. But I don't know if I would agree with your definition of morality. I think you're using a very sort of hard definition that I don't think most people use when they say morality.
I kind of agree with you on that. But the reason why I'm sort of delineating between those two is because there is a view of morality that is dogmatic. And again, lots of examples are used that. Charter of Rights and Freedom are dogmatic rights.
Well, could you give me an example of why it's dogmatic?
Why would you say, and you may be able to make this ethical, so I'm not saying there it's, but why is the right to free speech an immutable right?
Well, see, if you're asking me, I'm going to sort of fall back to what I've read in a book by Sam Harris. You may have heard of it. You know, when I think of what is moral, I sort of have this kind of pseudo...
We both know what you're talking about.
Yeah.
So, psychology and evolution combined into one sort of catchphrase.
Yeah. But I'm going to look at it from the point of view of sort of the way Sam Harris would outline, you know, and sort of what Sam Harris kind of said in the moral landscape, that we should embrace sort of a system of laws that allow for human flourishing. Now, being a student of history, I've had a pretty good idea of what systems seem to work for us as human beings. And free speech, to me, seems to make the most amount of sense for us as a society. We seem to flourish better when we have free speech. The times when we haven't had free speech have either been really sort of bloody or really bad for human, for you know, the species as a whole. So for me, it's not so much a matter of I see free speech as sort of like this sort of moral imperative that's been handed down to us by, I don't know, Pierre Trudeau or something. I kind of look at it more as what is going to make our society most able to allow our people, our citizens, to flourish?
And again, so I would say that would be ethical.
Yeah.
Ethically, you know. And in an odd sort of way, I think the Canadian Constitution is a far better document than the American Constitution, irrespective of God being in ours, is the fact that we have these lists of rights. But one of the things that's in our Constitution says, well, these rights should be upheld to, except when they become contradictory to the benefit of society. Mm-hmm. So the American Constitution says there's an absolute right to free speech, period, right? It's, you know, whereas the Canadian Constitution says, well, you have a right to free speech, but there are exceptions, and those exceptions must be justified, and there's a whole sort of set of rational hoops you have to go through, but it's not dogmatic. It is... your free speech can be limited if it is for the betterment of society. Mm-hmm. And I know that leads into a whole other idea of relativism. And I think that goes, we can get around that hoop again, like science, by making an appeal to history. I mean, we know more freedom of speech, at least, is better because of historical evidence. Again, that becomes an empirical claim, not a dogmatic claim. Mm-hmm. And because the word morality has such baggage with it, that's why I don't like the word morality. I realize you can use it in sort of a colloquial term and say, you know, oh, that was, you know, this is a moral law, or we did this morally, right? And that's true. I think most skeptics could use that term and not be too far down the rabbit hole. But it does. It comes with so much baggage that it is a all or nothing sort of thing. I mean, again, if a law is created ethically, it is not a moral law or an ethical law. It was just created that way. But if you say a law is a moral law, that has a lot more baggage. There's a permanence to that.
Well, then, like, going back to sort of the original question here, how would we approach the question of legislating when it comes to gender selection abortions?
Excellent. In fact, I made some comments on the blog post to someone who had brought up the fact that in places like India and China, it is a major issue, that there are thousands of prospective women who are being aborted prior to birth because of this. I think in those particular countries, the sex ratio has been distorted to such a point that it actually becomes a harm to society, whereas this kind of law may be a rational choice. It may be something that does make for a better world. Whereas I think in Canada, and this is one of my complaints about it here in Canada, is that although it is a minor problem in some communities, it is not a major problem to society as a whole. And as such, I don't think that it has the necessity to become a law here in Canada. So how would I make that decision? Is there a danger or harm being done to society? In Canada, I would say no. In India, I would say yes. But if you somehow cast this law as either moral or immoral, then you can't say it's all right here in Canada, but not right in India. There's this baggage that's over top of it.
Okay, so if we're assuming that we need to use our critical thinking and our skepticism to inform what laws we make, surely, though, we are going to run into problems where we think, okay, using marijuana, bad. 10-20 years down the road, we discover, oh, wait, it's actually good. So we got to go back and change the laws. Now, let's assume this happens a lot. Are we not going to have a very kind of in-and-out system of enforcing laws? I mean, let's say, you know, we arrest a bunch of people for smoking pot, and then it's like 10 years later we're letting them out again. But then we find out that while smoking pot is okay, smoking crack is not. So they were back in jail. And then 5 years later, they're back out again. I mean, are we not setting ourselves up for some very sort of wacky shenanigans when it comes to our legal system?
Well, and I think most legal systems in the world have actually kind of accommodated this. Because in the first sense, then maybe yes. I mean, if our knowledge changes so rapidly and we are so eager to legislate on this particular issue, which raises up the whole other question as to what qualifies as something to be legislated in the first place. If we do not know for sure one way or the other whether A is good or bad, then that in itself becomes a question, should we legislate for it? As a society, we do tend to take a precautionary form that until we know that it's relatively good, we will tend to say, well, let's not promote this in our society. And if we think that it's harmful, we should try and dissuade from it. But things that we have a much stronger historical evidence for, we tend to put into a special category of law that we call constitutional law. And that is why different levels of law that becomes these sort of breaks as to prevent this sort of every day there's a new law, there's a new change. So simple little things tend to be not law at all. They tend to be sort of a policy, government policy. You know, this is when you go to the to get your license for a driver's license, the actual forms you have to fill out and actual process, that can change month, well, hopefully not month to month, but that can change quite rapidly. And those are things that we don't really have a big issue with because it's not that important to the stability of society. Then we have another level, which we call regular law. And regular law tends to have, you know, tends to be much more variable. And it is slower in the sense because in order to change the law, you have to go through Parliament and you have to actually change the act. Whereas with civil law, can change quicker because all you need is one case that changes everything. Then we have this top level of law that we call constitutional law, which is extremely hard to change because these things we find that if they do change, they will profoundly affect the way our society operates. So we should change them over time, but we should do so with a preponderance of evidence and with an understanding that this can be game changers. So if we said next week that free speech is going to be dropped from our Constitution, that's going to be a huge game changer. And the Constitution innately makes it slow to make that change, and that if we do make that change, we do so with very sober realization of the consequences thereof.
Mm-hmm. So I guess the question then ultimately becomes, how emotional are we when it comes to our lawmaking process? Because it seems to me that this kind of sort of evidence-based form of ethics requires a fair bit of sort of sober second thought, whereas morality seems to me to be more of almost a snap judgment. It's more sort of visceral. And it doesn't leave a lot of room for careful skeptical scrutiny.
I think one of the differences you have here is that morality tends to be your belief ingrained in stone. Ethics or ethical thinking can start from, because I mean, we're humans and we have our own emotions and there are new questions that come up. It may begin in a belief. I may believe this to be true, but it is mutable. It is allowed to evolve over time as our knowledge of the universe changes, as we have more and more data points. And again, I guess I'm not saying 100% that we cannot use our beliefs when it comes to creating laws, because at some point that is where it all begins. But when we have morality, we're stuck with beliefs. We stop at beliefs. We no longer move from that. Because again, something is either moral or immoral. There's no moral-ish.
Mm-hmm.
Whereas ethical thinking allows for the process.
Well, it certainly is an interesting debate. And from my point of view, it sort of reminds me of the debate that went around when Sam Harris came up with his book, The Moral Landscape, because it sounds like you're kind of advocating the same thing.
Yeah, in fact, if I was him, I would have changed it to The Ethical Landscape.
Yeah. Right?
Yeah. No, words are important in some cases, and I mean, that's where Sam Harris got into a lot of trouble, is because he was kind of saying, this is moral, and this is immoral. Although, he meant to say, if we use these processes, we will come up with laws that are better and we'll get rid of some laws that are worse, or some beliefs.
Right. Well, I think it was kind of, he was almost sort of saying that the reason we even think these things are moral is through this sort of evolutionary psychology that, we flourish when this sort of code of ethics is in place. So ergo, we've enshrined it, this kind of moral status, because it's helped us survive this far.
Well, and there goes the other, great quandary of human consciousness and society, is that up until about 10,000 years ago or so, the idea of evolutionary psychology, I think, was much more pivotal to our survival. Because again, if you're in a hunter-gatherer group, your belief systems, which is largely all you have, literally could mean life or death for your entire group. But now we live in a society that's much more complex, where it is possible for me to have very counterproductive, very harmful belief systems, as long as it's contained in a smaller aquarium, right? Mm-hmm. I mean, we've got Fred Phelps and his nut jobs, right?
Yeah.
I mean, those are very harmful to society. But there's enough of the rest of society that it doesn't cause a collapse of our species, right?
Right.
And that's why we can kind of, not jump over evolutionary psychology, but evolutionary psychology now becomes one aspect of society as opposed to a genetic aspect of it.
Right. Well, why don't we go to one more commercial break here on the show, Radio Free Thinker, and we'll return with our skeptical highlights after this.
This is Phil Plait of BadAstronomy.com, and you're listening to CITR 101.9 FM for UBC in Vancouver, British Columbia.
And we're back on Radio Free Thinker. So we're running out of time here on the show. Let's go to our skeptical highlights for today. Don, why don't you give us yours?
Yes, I've got a very interesting one. I have Brother Guy. That's a bit longer. He's got a last name that no one can pronounce, I'm sure. But he's going to be at the Macmillan Space Center Saturday, February 25th. Doors open at 6 o'clock. Lecture begins at 7:30. He's asking for donations of $20. Please don't give him. Only because I'm prejudiced against religious people. But the lecture itself is Pluto in the Vatican, How Do Science and Religion Handle Change in Our Understanding of Reality? Quote from the poster, how does science and religion each deal with new information, end quote, and how do we determine the difference between essential truths and things we've just gotten used to over a long period of time? Can we have a little more sympathy for the church at the time of Galileo by realizing how hard it is for us to let go of our deeply cherished but flawed views of the universe?
Can I answer that now? No, we can't.
Well, actually, you know, I'm going to take this as a very positive. This is a person who is a representative of the Vatican who just acknowledged that their views of the universe is deeply flawed and they're willing to change. This is a crack addict saying, I need an intervention.
Yeah. He's a couple of hundred years too late on that one, but nevertheless.
Well, that was one of the things I thought was kind of funny is, you know, they wanted a little sympathy for the church. And I'm sort of thinking, well, how much sympathy did they give to the people they burnt at the stake for heresy and such?
Right. Well, I mean, this could be interesting. I mean, you know, church apologetics and science, and it says Pluto, so I guess they're going to be talking about Pluto for some reason. But
I wonder if he still thinks it's a planet.
What a moron. Well, my skeptical highlight is a fun one, and it's coming up. I'm really quite excited about this. The third annual Cross Canada Skeptical Smackdown, which is happening Wednesday, March 14th at 7:30.
You're not advocating violent sport, are you?
No, I'm not. The Cross Canada Skeptical Smackdown is a fun and challenging, but more specifically, British-style pub quiz focusing on critical thinking and scientific topics. It occurs every year at multiple locations across Canada with local and national bragging rights at stake. This year in Vancouver, it's happening at the Billy Bishop Legion, and we encourage you to come with your fellow skeptics, form teams, about four people or so, and compete. There will be a winner at the Billy Bishop, the team that answers the most questions correctly. But the fun part is, we have teams all over the country, in Kelowna and Edmonton and Toronto and Halifax, all over the place, and they'll all be taking the quiz as well. So you'll find out which group of people in Canada is the most skeptically informed of all groups.
Go Vancouver!
I should point out that in the past, Radio Free Thinker has competed in the Skeptical Smackdown quiz, and we have trounced our opponents on other skeptical podcasts. Unfortunately, for the performance of certain teams, the ultimate skeptical fanboy, Fred Bremer, will not be in attendance at this Skeptical Smackdown. So
no.
We'll have a new national champion at some point, regardless of perhaps someone else this time. But anyway, it should be a lot of fun, so come on by on the 14th to the Billy Bishop. And if you're in a different community, not in Vancouver, and you want to organize your own Cross Canada Skeptical Smackdown, do get in touch with the organizers. You can find their contact information up on Skeptic North, and you can host your own Skeptical Smackdown.
Woo! Yes, flex your skeptical brain and muscle.
Absolutely.
And also, for those people who are wanting to step out tonight, Vancouver's Skeptics in the Pub downtown is going on. It's at the Railway Club. Starts at 7:30, so maybe you can meet up and start forming your teams.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, we're pretty much out of time here on Radio Free Thinker, so a big thank you to everyone who tuned in to listen. This is Ethan, your free-thinking historian.
And this is Don saying, eyes open, minds on.
And if Jenna was here, she would say something smart and funny about...
I think she'd say, the real world is amazing.
Yeah, or something like that. I can't ever really understand what she says.
I don't want to infringe on her copyright, so.
Yeah, but, well, hopefully we'll all be back next week, so stay tuned for more Radio Free Thinker coming up later on.
If you wish to make an apple pie from scratch, you must first invent the universe.
Thanks for listening to Radio Free Thinker. Remember to visit us online at radiofreethinker.com and subscribe to the podcast on iTunes. If you have any local skeptical events you would like us to mention on the air, email us at info@radiofreethinker.com.
Venture to the stars.